Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-hosts Jake Towne and Gene DiNardo. It is Thursday, April 19, 2012, and here are some of the headlines we're looking at today. You think the Fed is hard to audit? You want to end the Fed? Well, Gene DiNardo's got a little information about how the Fed is a piece of cake compared to the Pentagon, and Jake's going to be reporting on the various scandals that the U.S. government has been facing, the Secret Service for the prostitution scandal, the U.S. soldiers posing, well, I don't even want to say what they're posing with, and the GSA convention and bribery scandal, all kinds of scandals facing the Obama administration this week. Plus, we're going to take a look at what's happening with the bond market over in Europe, because as much as the media wants to pretend otherwise, it's the crisis that just doesn't want to go away. But we're going to start off with those scandals because that's what's getting everybody's attention this week. And Jake, let's start off with what's going on with that Secret Service scandal. That one just really woke a lot of people up.
Yes, for those that are unaware, when the president travels abroad, there's kind of like a virtual city or almost an army that travels with him of military helicopters. They import all the vehicles. It's a real to-do, and I'm trying to remember the exact number, but it's well over 1,000 people are going whenever you see, like, on camera you only see the president, but he was in Colombia for a meeting, the Summit of the Americas, but prior to that conference, 11, a total of 11 members of the Secret Service, which protects the president and other top officials, have been linked by the agency to the controversy, which is that a unpaid prostitute that was brought back to the hotel wanted to be paid about $800, and the Secret Service agent allegedly said he would just pay her $30, and she didn't want to go away without being paid, and what ended up happening was the police in the hotel came in. The prostitute said she had no idea that he was with President Obama, and ended up, the few of the Secret Service agents that were there ended up putting together $200, which is probably whatever they had in cash, and gave it to her, and she ended up leaving, but not before this controversy has boiled up, which has been obviously condemned by the Democrat Obama administration. There has been several resignations and firings already in the Secret Service. But I think the takeaway from this is I think this is just the time that they've been caught. Every time these caravans or virtual cities go from country to country, this is the type of stuff that they pretty much typically do, except they usually don't get caught. So,
means it also they're used to paying a lot lower wage.
Yeah, the dollar doesn't buy as much as it used to anymore. And, yeah, so this is the Secret Service, of course, is a branch that has kind of very little scandals in the past that have been revealed to the public, and this is kind of like a blemish. So hopefully you'll see heads rolling at the Secret Service, but I wouldn't count on it.
You know, it struck me that this is like I don't know what to call it, the poor man's version of James Bond. I mean, James Bond is much more, you know, he has much more finesse about it. I mean, he basically walks up, strolls up to the baccarat table and has a few hands, and the beautiful girl is eyeing him and so forth, and he gets into a laissez-faire conversation, you know, I'm too cool for my shoes kind of thing. This isn't anything like that, is it?
No, definitely not, and what remains to be known. I mean, obviously the Secret Service were on the taxpayer dime in terms of staying at the hotel and everything. It's unknown exactly where this money is coming from. Of course, it's taxpayer money at the end of the day. Their salaries come from taxpayers. And while they're, on the job, it's unacceptable. But to pretend that it's something that's irregular and happens every now and then, I think is pretty naive.
Absolutely true. And it was only the beginning of the scandals this week. I mean, this was the week full of scandals for the Obama administration, which I suppose it's better that from their perspective that it happens this time of year than, say, in October. But still, this is an embarrassing time for the Obama administration.
Oh, it sure is. And the General Service Administration was the next scandal. And for people that don't know what the General Service Administration is, which I don't know, it does employ 12,000 bureaucrats, but it is an independent agency of the U.S. government. What it does is it supplies products and communications for U.S. government offices, provides transportation office space to federal employees, and get this, develops government-wide cost-minimizing policies.
Yeah, right.
Another management task. So the GSA held a convention 11 months ago, and this might have been brought up kind of at the politic time in Las Vegas, and cost $800,000. Some of the things that they were spending taxpayer money on, they spent $75,000 to have teams put together bikes, 24 teams put together bikes, and the bikes were donated to a charity, so at least something good happened out of the $75,000, but probably a bit too much. They spent $6,000 on commemorative coins to commemorate their great convention. And when the head of the GSA was brought before Congress to testify on all this, he took the Fifth Amendment, which is he might have been following the practices of the MF Global secretary who took the Fifth Amendment to protect John Corzine and the rest of the crooks at MF Global. But in this case, he's a federal bureaucrat, and he won't even say everything that was going on. But what kind of remains not so much talked about is that the General Service Administration's Inspector General actually brought this up to Congress, in that there is an investigation on the improper use of funds, which could be including, if you listen to the testimony on White Capitol Hill, bribery and kickbacks. So there could have been just a little bit more than the government agency spending quite a bit. Could have been quite a bit worse, which might be the real reason why the head of the GSA took the Fifth Amendment. And, you know, for those types of people that say, like, oh, President Obama just needs to get, you know, his house in order. You know, this is a one-time thing. It'll never happen again. I remind everybody that back in 2009, right after Obama took office, the 700 of the Social Security Administration's 62,000-plus employees went to a fancy resort in Phoenix. They spent $700,000, so pretty much roughly the same amount. And the Obama administration really didn't take any proper means to address or get rid of it. So this type of thing is, again, happening. And, again, same thing what we say before with the Secret Service and the prostitution. This is just something that keeps going on again and again and again in government. And if you go from branch to branch and take a look at what they're actually spending money on, you're going to find pretty much the same thing. I mean, the individual congressman bringing up things like $44 breakfast per person in Las Vegas, which everybody knows that if you go to Las Vegas, breakfast is a lot cheaper.
But, yeah.
They're paying government rates.
For normal people.
Yeah, it's not breakfast that's expensive, it's the casinos.
Yeah, and this is just what happens when, you know, you give other people, namely the bureaucrats, the ability to spend other people's money. And, you know, even the GSA, it's kind of like a miniature fiefdom. I mean, they have 12,000 employees, and they're just a subsidiary function. I mean, their main thing is to provide products and communications and develop government-wide cost-minimizing policies across the government.
You probably don't spend too much time on that part of it.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. So,
who does the – is it the Justice Department that would do the investigation or what?
Well, when they're not at a convention, sure.
No, of the GSA, would it
– No, I mean, when the Justice Department's not at a convention.
Yeah, maybe they're at a convention. They have to call them and bring them home.
Yeah, well, the Inspector General has brought this up, and I'm not quite sure if he brings in the DOJ or what have you. I'm sure that they're going to wait for this whole thing to be. The Congressman Micah, who's in charge of the hearings, has indicated that, quote, the Las Vegas fiasco is just the tip of the iceberg, unquote, meaning that there could be, since the GSA, I mean, their budget is $21 billion, but they do a lot of the purchasing and that sort of thing for the government. And if you have special parties, which obviously this exists, special parties trying to get favoritism from the government in terms of contracts and what have you, you know, by greasing the skids or bribery at the GSA, kind of a good place to make your money. And it seems that some of this has been uncovered, so this is probably maybe the end of the complaint about the $800,000 convention, but it's probably just the start of unmasking everything that's kind of been going on in just this one federal bureaucracy.
You know, I try to be positive about stuff on here, or at least here on the show I try to make jokes about things so that I can at least attempt to be positive. But I have to admit, I hear a story like this, and the cynical side of me comes out. And what I mean by that is, yes, this is all very serious. I mean, there's a lot of corruption going on here, very apparent. It's going to make a lot of taxpayers very mad. But we're talking about penny ante stuff compared to a lot of what goes on in the government. I mean, you know, even $800,000 is a drop in the bucket compared to what the government spends minute by minute on, you know, this broad range of things that it spends money on. And it just, this is where maybe I'm just being too cynical, but it makes me wonder if perhaps this is a play to distract attention from the hundreds of billions and even trillions of dollars that are being spent by the government to drive us dramatically outside of the range of anything close to a balanced budget, just by focusing on something that amounts to next to nothing.
Well, I think you're right on the drop in the bucket. I think that's the way they look at it. They look at it as, you know, just change laying around, and why not spend it on ourselves? And, you know, it was easy to come by. You know, once I think the real crime is giving them the money in the first place.
And the power.
And the power, right.
Oh, well. I just had my cynical rant for the day, so I'm okay now. Meanwhile, we're going to go look at something else that has a cynical side to it. Gee, you have a fascinating tale here, and I love the headline you gave me. The headline says, you think the Fed is hard to audit? It's a piece of cake compared to the Pentagon. I mean, that's a great headline. You
well,
got to tell us what the details are about that.
I think they've actually made more progress with the Fed. And here's some of the history. The budget for this fiscal year for the Pentagon is $530 billion. It's actually for the Department of Defense. It's the federal government's largest agency and the third biggest spending item, trailing only Social Security and the two health care programs put together, Medicare and Medicaid. Even so, the Pentagon and its friends in the White House and Congress keep asking for more. The fiscal 2013 budget released by the White House reduces defense spending to $525 billion in 2013 before boosting it to $534 billion in 2014 and $546 billion in 2015. The budget that was written, proposal that was written by the House Republican calls for $554 billion for defense next year. And this is outside of Homeland Security, which I believe is another 300 and some billion. Despite the fact that, I think this quote is, Peter DeFazio, he's a congressman from Oregon. He said, despite the fact that the Pentagon is the largest and most expensive department in the federal government, it has never passed a financial audit. Okay, now listen to this phrase. This is how absurd the whole thing is. This is what he said. In fact, under current law, the Pentagon is exempt from a federal law that requires all federal agencies to complete annual audits, which makes absolutely no sense, but, you know, they're just not going to audit them. The best place to start is 1990. In the year 1990, Congress passed legislation requiring all federal agencies to present audible financial statements. It was a reasonable standard for most agencies to satisfy, and every federal department did, except one, and that's the Pentagon. The Pentagon promised to create a system to make its books auditable by 2017. That was in 1990. Congress accepted the pledge, which was an estimate rather than a hard mandate. As any business person knows, you first have to have a system in place to track income and expenses and other parts of your budget. in order to begin the audit in the first place. Once there, you can audit, and you can start an audit that provides a detailed thumbnail of your financial well-being. The Pentagon hasn't accomplished either one, so they don't even have any kind of system that you could audit. Peter DeFazio sponsored an amendment to the defense bill last year that would require the Pentagon to organize its books so they can be audited. This is after 20-some years, I guess. That step has yet to be satisfied, and DeFazio's measure was stripped during negotiations between the House and Senate. And I'd really like to know who, you know, what group of Congress people and senators were against it. But obviously it was a majority. As far back as 1995, the General Accounting Office, which has been recently, or since then, has been renamed the Government Accountability Office, the independent investigative arm of Commerce deemed the Pentagon's financial management to be high risk. In 2000, the GAO found that nearly one-third of the accounting entries in the Pentagon's budget were untraceable. It goes on to say that the has continued to report significant weaknesses in the department's ability to provide timely, reliable, consistent, and accurate information for management analysis, decision-making, and reporting. The year after that, the GAO found that half of the Pentagon's $366 billion in contract awards, so that would be 2010, I believe, were never even completed. They don't even know what happened to $366 billion. In an appearance before the Senate Budget Committee in March, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta declared that the department would be fully audible by 2014 instead of waiting to 2017, which he said was absolutely crazy. And he said, that's frankly something we owe the taxpayer. Good luck with that one. So they've never been audited. They don't know what they're doing. It's the behind Social Security and Medicare, which you know is highly, I think, is fairly transparent for government agencies because the money, at least you have to show where it goes. They're the biggest spender, and nobody knows what they're spending it on.
You know, it just strikes me that your headline is really quite apropos, because what the Pentagon should be doing is taking their cue from the Fed. Because the way the Fed gets audited is they do an internal audit, and then they call in the representatives from the government administration and say, okay, we did our audit, here are the results of the audit, and the bureaucrats say, oh, well, then they've been audited, it's okay.
You know, you're absolutely right. That's a lot safer, you know, from their standpoint. It is. But, you know, I think they think they're more powerful. I think they just believe they're above, well, like DeFazio said, above the current law, or however he phrased it. It's an absurdity, and it exists for the same reason of, you know, what Jake has just been talking about. Once they have the power and our money, and, you know, especially in those amounts, there's really no way to make them accountable, I don't think. It would take so much to account for so much money and so much power, organized power. It would just be, Herculean task. How do you say that?
Herculean.
Yep, Herculean.
Herculean. Yes.
So it's quite a story.
it is an amazing story. And one of the things that grabs my attention about it is the one piece where you mentioned that there was some $300 billion that they just kind of lost track of. Now, I look at that number, $300 billion. That, you know, before the decimal point, that's nine digits worth of numbers, right?
Exactly.
And the story that Jake was talking about, which is the one that's grabbing all the headlines, has numbers that are six digits long. So basically, the story that is about the stuff that is 1,000 times more money involved is not getting the attention that the story about the tiny drop in the bucket is getting.
That's a great point, and it's also a story that's been going on for decades. Like the article says, 1990 is when they basically made most of the agencies accountable, not all of them, but most of them. And it's been going on since 1990. There's been no progress, and do we ever hear about it?
Well, we hear about it here on the Freedom News.
Only on this show, yeah, and. You know, both of them are important, but yeah, the $366 billion is over half of their budget. you know, so over half their budget, they don't have any idea if they even put the contracts out there. I mean, they know they spent the money, but they don't know where it went.
Oh, I know it was here before. I saw it. Honestly, it was on my desk. I saw it.
$300 billion, and it just slipped out the door.
Oh, good grief. Well, it does raise a question in my mind, and the question ties in with Jake's next story, because, Jake, it makes you wonder if there was better auditing going on at the Pentagon, would this in some way have trickled down to prevent, say, what happened with those U.S. soldiers who were caught posing, oh, God, I hate to say it. I don't even want to say it. Give us the details on what it was they were caught
doing.
We'll
make Jake say it.
Yeah, make Jake say it. But, no.
Well, you're the one who came up with the story, so
yeah,
you're the one that got reported.
All right. U.S. Soldiers were caught trophy photographs posing with the mangled bodies of Afghan insurgent bombers. This was condemned by the Afghan president, Tarmid Karzai, as inhuman. He has called for a rapid transition from NATO to Afghan security to prevent more such incidents. So Afghanistan is continuing to look to try and get these out. And some of these photographs were of bombers that either blown themselves up in a failed attack or blew up by mistake. Not all these photographs were released. I forget which newspaper. It was released, I think, to the Times out of Great Britain or what have you. But they were told by the military not to publish the photos, and they ended up selecting one or two for the populace to view. And, you know, one of them, they're holding up severed legs, by the ankles and, kind of giving a thumbs up and smiling and that sort of thing. So it's very, very disgusting. Yes, the platoons had were in the photographs had some casualties by IEDs and suicide bombers, but it certainly doesn't condone this type of attitude. One of the photos, a U.S. Paratrooper posed next with an unofficial patch placed on his body that said Zombie Hunter, who always posing with these corpses. So, you know, this is not the first time. It's kind of unbelievable how these things just kind of keep going. I mean, already in the past year, there was the U.S. Troops, burning, quote-unquote, by mistake, copies of the Koran, which incensed all of Afghanistan, as well as the killing of 17 villagers when apparently an allegedly a U.S. soldier kind of went nuts and just went out there and killed women, children, and men as well. They were completely innocent civilians. So this whole thing just kind of destabilizes the regime even more. Four U.S. soldiers died in a helicopter crash today, and there was an offensive launched in Kabul to kind of demonstrate that the Taliban is not out at all. And from the severity of the attacks and all the reports, you know, what they say about a war is, like, you know, if you're not winning it, you're probably losing it. And with us staying over there, losing the war and these sorts of things, the effort that Petraeus, who now heads the CIA, kind of put in there to win the hearts and minds, kind of like the modern Vietnam war counterinsurgency battle, has really been lost with these types of public relations and losses. And I guess the only bright side from this is that maybe, just maybe, the U.S. Will be leaving Afghanistan faster than anticipated. Already, Australia is talking about pulling out their troops faster than anticipated. So hopefully that all happen, and Afghanistan can go back to being ruled by the Afghans.
I just keep going back to the previous story and the trail stories we have here. I mean, the previous story was about the fact that the Pentagon never gets audited, which essentially is another way of saying there is no accountability. I mean, it's even difficult to argue that the Pentagon is accountable to the president if the president doesn't even know where the money was spent. And the only way he can know that is if they can be audited and it can be shown where the money was spent. Well, if that level of accountability is missing, how can anyone, including the president, be sure that any other levels of accountability are still integral to the Pentagon? And to me, the fact that you get this kind of activity with down at the lower end of the echelons, with U.S. soldiers posing with dead suicide bomber body parts, I mean, how much more evidence do you need at the lower end and at the higher end that accountability is completely missing?
Yeah, they're both, right. they're both traced to accountability. Obviously, those soldiers weren't accountable to their higher ups or that was approved behavior, whichever, and that means that, you know, it's somewhere along the line. If you know you're going to say that kind of behavior is wrong in war and kind of present this molded picture of war, you know, war to do good, I guess is what they're trying to do. Then at some point somebody wasn't accountable, and you know, that's a great point.
Now, you know, just to reiterate that they keep kind of repeating the same mistakes, proving that they're incapable of being accountable and putting in place corrective actions. You know, one only has to think back several years to the prison where you had U.S. soldiers posing with prisoners that were alive, but, you know, making them pose naked and with dogs and all these other horrific scenes. It just proves that, you know, when they're doing these things, they have to have kind of in the back of their mind, you know, that if these got out, there would be some type of payback and or blowback, really. And, you know, war is a tough thing. The atrocities just are going to be in any war. Doesn't matter if it's U.S. soldiers or Russian soldiers or NATO soldiers or whatever, and it's best not to even be involved. And like you were saying, Walt, you also have to remember that each of the soldiers that are in the photos, you know, we're paying $1 million by the Pentagon estimate a year to have them over there. So, you know, 100,000 troops times $1 million apiece, that comes out to a lot.
A lot.
Comes out to a lot of GSA conventions is what that
comes
out.
Yeah, a lot of GSA conventions.
Yeah, the whole thing is, I think, in a big way, is really hypocritical. I mean, it's part of this illusion they try to paint that war is a tool to make a better world. You know, I mean, all these wars are, you know, the point supposedly, what the state tells everybody is that, you know, we're molding the world. We're gonna get rid of this dictator. You know, we're gonna clean up this country. And basically, these people, you know, even though, you know, those things are just terrible things, what they were doing with the photos and like you say, the prisoners before and all that. But that's what they do in war. I mean, that is war. And, you know, I think even this fact of making this big uproar about it and saying, oh, we have to punish these people, you know, it's part of that illusion to make us all kind of try to accept war as a daily activity and something that is good in the end when it really isn't.
And also, I think it's very important to remember, as you guys know, I am no fan of the president, but I'm also no fan of his opponents over in the Republican Party. And it's the Republicans who, in almost knee-jerk reaction, will be the first ones to say, we can't touch the Pentagon spending. We can't touch any
exactly,
of that.
Exactly, right.
And they say that in the face of what is clearly top-to-bottom corruption without any accountability. How Republicans can justify that is beyond me.
It's ridiculous, and it's again, it's hypocritical, you know, because they're also the ones saying, oh, the government's too big, we got to cut back on this. It seems like what they want to cut back on is food stamps, you know, that,
yeah,
you know, which is just a couple pennies here and there of people who, you know, who most of them do need the food, you know, not all of them, of course, but, you know, it's so hypocritical, it's ridiculous. And I say the same thing. I'm not a fan of either side, but the Republican stance on that is just hilarious, I think.
Well, we're going to take a break so we can all go throw up, and then after the break, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the craziness that goes on, including some real craziness from over in Norway, where a mass murderer made some absolutely unbelievable claims that, well, actually, they're not all that unbelievable because they sound very familiar in some ways. Plus, we're going to take a look, like promised at the top of the hour, at what's going on with the Spanish bond markets as well as the Italian bond market, because despite everything that you've heard, things are not rosy. Things are continuing to boil over there. It is going to get worse. So we'll cover that, plus a little bit about the campaign after the break. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We will be right back.
Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
run and go back to your dial, turn it up. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And as promised before the break, want to take a look at what's happening over in Europe, because despite the fact that the media are not reporting what is going on there in any major way, things are continuing to brew there. The financial crisis is not over there. It isn't over here either, but it's particularly boiling over there. Spain is at the center of it. And let's just go over some of the things that happened this week. Well, first, let's look at what today's headlines tell us. According to the headlines today, Spain's bond auction met with decent demand, but it failed to keep yields in check or inspire global financial markets. And in fact, they report that the yields had dipped a little bit. That's considered good news because it means that the cost of Spanish debt is in the report anyway, is coming down. So that means it's coming under control. But is that really true? In order to answer that question, we have to go back a week. We have to go to last Friday. And last Friday, basically the turmoil started to come out again in the marketplace when it was disclosed by the Bank of Spain that the country's largest institutions had borrowed 316 billion euros from the European Central Bank in March, almost twice the 169.8 billion they borrowed in February. This led to traders dumping Spanish stocks and buying insurance against Madrid defaulting on Friday, and basically sent the entire markets into a whirlwind of confusion and no one knowing what's happening throughout the weekend. Then come Monday, turns out that the traders did pay attention. They did notice what was going on, and they ended up bidding up the cost of the Spanish bond offerings that came out on Monday to the point where they exceeded the 6% figure. Now, that's a psychologically important figure because it is 1 point away from the 7% figure, and the 7% figure is where it is generally accepted by most of the marketplace that at that point Spain is defaulting because it's getting at that point too expensive to maintain the debt. So it's a very serious number that's being measured here. And so once it jumped up above the 6% mark, everybody was saying, oh, my God, people were trying to dump the paper as fast as they could. Then on Tuesday, the paper market starts to come down a little bit. It comes down below the 6% figure. Actually, it finished Monday just below at 5.93%. Tuesday starts to come down a little bit to the 5.8% or thereabouts. And then Wednesday down to 5.7-something, and then today back up above 5.8. And the one thought that occurred to me as I was watching all this, Jake, and Jake, I know you follow this about as much as I do, is that as all this activity is happening, I'm asking myself, okay, who's buying? Right? We just had an announcement from the Spanish government and the European Central Bank that Spain had been borrowing from the ECB. The Spanish banks had been borrowing from the ECB at twice the rate in March that they were in February. That sent the market into turmoil. And then all of a sudden on Tuesday, after the bond market exceeded the 6% level, all of a sudden there are buyers. Where did these buyers come from? And Jake, I guess the only answer that comes to my mind is it must be the central bank.
Well, it's most likely not the Spanish people because they're pretty much all unemployed and left destitute, really, by the central bank and the actions of their government. So, but yeah, exactly who the buyers are. There's probably some high-level folks buying, but you know, with all the news is out there, it's kind of hard to see why you know, smart money, as it were, would plow into Spanish bonds at this point instead of you know, waiting for this cascade to kind of happen before stepping in. So there probably is you know, behind the scenes support to it, because certainly I'm sure that the way that the European Central Bank views it is if they kind of plug in the hole in the dam right now, it won't get any worse. And, you know, the problem is they're already plugging up Greece, and Portugal's already worse than Spain, but a lot smaller than Spain. And I think, you know, the prognosis really for that whole region in terms of their governments is still very bad. The German bonds are about 1.7% for a 10-year bond, so they're actually doing pretty decent, but a lot of folks are kind of going into that for, you know, quote unquote safety, since German, in terms of its economy and government, is what do they say, like the best best looking house on the
in the ghetto or what have you. So so I would say today, like the Spanish bonds on the 10-year bond were mildly up to, I think, a little bit shy of 6%. So I don't think this is over at all. The U.S. market didn't really seem to be reacting so much to the news in Spain and the news from Europe today as it was from a lot of the earnings from the banks and manufacturers. And I think the stock market was mildly down, but not down like a 0.5%. So just pretty much no change.
Yeah, that's
today.
Today.
Who knows about tomorrow?
Or at least for the next hour, right?
Right.
But what you were saying about unemployment and the economy is absolutely correct. I mean, unemployment right now in Spain is running at 23%. And when you look at for those under 30, it's almost 50%. Half the country under 30 is currently unemployed. On top of that, the economy is in its second full quarter of what they call negative growth, which means they're fully expected to enter an official recession this quarter. The economy is expected to contract by 1.7% for the year. I mean, clearly, this economy is in very, very bad shape. The only good thing I can say, and I always try to find the silver lining of this kind of thing, the only good thing I can say is you do have to go through the pain in order to get to the healthy part. And I don't know that they actually have the fortitude to go all the way through the pain. I mean, there are so many people, so many Keynesians out there who are going to say, we got to throw more money into it, we got to throw more money into it, that's the only way to stop the pain, which is, of course, exactly the wrong answer, because in the long run, you just increase the pain even more. But nevertheless, the fact is they are going through that pain. I just wonder whether or not they're going to actually get through it. I don't know that they're going to settle for it. I just have this feeling that the whole thing is going to fall apart in terms of the political coalitions involved. And when that happens, all bets are off, because Spain is such a huge economy. I mean, a default in Spain basically wrecks the European Union.
Yeah, you know, with the Europeans, with the EFSF, which is, you know, the European Financial Stability Fund, and the bailouts, whether they're from the IMF or what have you. But what a lot of these European countries are kind of counting on, bailouts predominantly from Germany. Kind of the funny thing about Spain is if Spain goes under, which seems more likely than not at this current point in time, Germany is on the hook for 40% of whatever is necessary to bail it out, which the German people obviously are very angry and upset with. And the Spanish people are on the hook for about 12% or so of the EFSF. So, you know, how does that compute for their, you know, the Spanish people to bail out their own problem? So it's getting to the point where, you know, one of these major countries kind of goes down. And there could be certain triggers, like, you know, if the challenger to Sarkozy is able to win, it's going to throw the whole France-German alliance kind of possibly into a split, and certainly will contribute a lot more tension, because the folks that are running against Sarkozy are highlighting his ineptitude on these subjects. So forget the date for the French election, but it's definitely going to be worth watching very closely.
My question is you mentioned half of the people under 30 in Spain are unemployed. What exactly do they do? I mean, is there a black market economy that they're not accounting for? Half the people under 30 with no job and nothing to do. I mean, it's... unless they're really creative, you know, arts and crafts or something.
They're spending some of their time writing.
Yeah, right.
And, I'm not quite sure. I would suspect that a lot of these socialist countries in Europe do have unemployment programs and that sort of like in the U.S. I'm not quite sure how many are getting that.
Bigger scale, maybe.
Yeah, but, you know, certainly it's on the mind of the Spanish government to kind of keep these people somewhat pacified so they don't rise up, because that could certainly happen.
Well, like in Italy, you know, has a large black market economy, and I think Greece does also. And, you know, Mexico is a good example, because they really have no way that they can figure an unemployment rate in Mexico, because the government gets most of its income, if not all, because they own the oil company, and they do tax people, but nobody pays it, or very few people bother to pay the tax. So they really don't know if people are working, and there's a huge black market economy, so they don't have. And I was just wondering if that was true with Spain or It's more, on the board where you can see the actual activity.
You're going to see more black market activity as the euro gets out of control. Right now, the euro is relative to, I don't know what, but it's relatively steady compared to what, shall we say, it could be.
Yeah.
And until that changes, there won't be a significant reason to avoid the euro-based economy. But once that changes, then you will see much more black market. I'm sure there must be some black market activity. But like Jake was saying, I suspect most of it is being financed by the government, providing the various kinds of safety net programs that the socialist nations are known to supply. And that's actually the crux of the problem, or at least part of the crux of the problem, because the Spanish government is already in deep doo-doo in terms of their sovereign debt. They're having trouble selling their debt. And if they keep pushing to sell more debt than the market can handle, then they start exceeding the interest rate, in other words, the return on investment that the Spanish government can afford to pay and still maintain their goal of austerity and trying to get their economy under control. So it becomes a losing battle at that point.
Yeah, a vicious cycle.
Very vicious cycle.
And it's just to imagine that, 5, 6, 7%, if you can imagine the U.S. government having to pay that percentage, it's just a phenomenal amount when you consider the amount of debt. Like, I think, don't we pay over half a trillion on interest on our loans, government loans, the federal loans every year? And to imagine, the interest rate increasing threefold, it's just amazing.
Well, Fed supporters will tell you that's what's so good about the Federal Reserve.
Sure.
Because what the Fed has been doing is they have been keeping interest rates down into the zero range. And when interest rates are in the zero range, that means that the amount that the government has to pay on its debt is going to be extremely low as well. So that's where the Fed watchers, the people who are on the side of the Fed, are going to say, see what a wonderful job the Fed is doing. They're preventing
right.
that from becoming a problem. But as you point out, it can't stay there. I mean, eventually, interest rates you can't make interest rates stay where you want them to. They have this weird tendency to go where they want to go. And when the market starts saying, hey, we really aren't willing to accept that level of low return on our investment, then guess what? The interest rates go up. So, we may not have that kind of interest rate level now, but, just wait a few years.
Yeah, if the money gets circulated, all the money that they've been printing like crazy, and it starts to circulate in the local economies, the interest, you're right. And that will just change the entire picture. We've mentioned that with real estate, I think, how, in light of the real estate market, in light of the interest rates, they're at such a low point, and they can only go up, which would make all the weaknesses of the real estate market even more obvious. And this is true of the debt, like you say. So it's really a tough situation for the Fed. I feel sorry for them.
And plus, as Jake, I'm sure, can tell us, it's not as if the Fed haven't been warning us that that's what they're going to do, because that's the whole exit strategy that the Fed has for this huge run-up they've created in the monetary base. Ultimately, they're counting on the economy to recover to some degree so they can raise interest rates again. That's the strategy. That's how the Fed proposes to back their way out of this massive monetary expansion that they've done so that it doesn't turn into a large inflation. But as we just detailed, the moment they do that, all of a sudden, our costs, the government, well, I don't know, are there costs in terms of paying back interest on money that you borrowed that came out of money created out of thin air? I don't know.
Yeah, count that for us.
But assuming that there is some pain associated with that, and I can't imagine how there wouldn't be in one way or another, I mean, that debt does come back to haunt us, because what is it up to now, $14, $15 trillion? And I think the Obama administration is saying that it's going to be up to $20 trillion within the next few years. I mean, once you get the interest rates up, that starts getting very expensive.
Yeah, and that's the critical thing. I think people dwell too much. I mean, you're right to mention $14, $15 trillion, because it's a huge amount, but it's actually the interest that's the critical factor. I mean, what we owe could be $500 trillion, and it really means nothing as long as we can make the payments. And that's, when it gets to that point, just like all these governments are running into that problem because they're at the breaking point. They can't make the payments. And So they manufacture more money and make payments with the new money.
And then, of course, the Fed supporters come in and say, well, look, you know, the Fed is all the Fed's profits are basically owned by the U.S. government. So really, if they're borrowing all that money from the Fed that the Fed created out of thin air, then they owe that money to themselves, so it doesn't make any difference.
Right.
Which, of course, completely ignores the fact that, hey, you still have this massive monetary expansion that is eventually going to lead to an inflation.
I think that's why people don't pay it. Normal, average people don't pay attention to it because it doesn't make any sense.
And that's the sad truth. It doesn't make any sense.
That's true.
Yep. And that's, that's one reason why we have our show. Well, we've basically beaten that horse to death for a bit. Let's go overseas once more to Europe. But this time, instead of looking at what's going on with the bond market, let's look at what's going on with a rather peculiar murder trial going on over in Norway. Gene, what are the details on that one?
Yeah, this Anders Behring Breivik, I hope I pronounced that right, in Norwegian, who was responsible for, he had actually admitted to killing 77 people last year. He's a self-described anti-Islamic militant, and he is pleading that he did it in self-defense, which
yeah.
is absurd. And it's kind of interesting, you know, it ties in a little bit. We don't know the exact details of the Florida case, but you know, apparently the guy was in his car following the kid, and then got out of his car, and he also is claiming it was self-defense. So maybe this is kind of the thing that's, you know, happening now. In the courtroom, the defendant proclaimed that he had acted in self-defense, bore no criminal guilt, and rejected the authority of the court. They had some pretty remarkable evidence that they played to a packed and shocked courtroom. Recordings of cell phone calls made by the gunman. He called the police several times, trying to give himself up, and he claims he had simply gone on killing because the officers took so long. I think they took an hour to get there or something like that. And it stated that 41 of the 77 killings occurred after his first call. Breivik has admitted on several occasions that he carried out the rampage in which 8 people died in the bombing and 69 were shot and killed on the island where the youth wing of the governing Labor Party was holding a summer camp. He remained mostly impassive as the evidence was presented, and at one point he seemed to stifle a yawn, if you can believe that. Only when the court viewed a video that Breivik had made before the attacks did he shed tears and dab at his face. Asked by a judge on Monday whether he wished to plead guilty, he said, "I acknowledge the acts, but I don't plead guilty as I claim I was doing it in self-defense." He had previously disclaimed his criminal responsibility on the ground that he was protecting Norway from Islamic immigration. That's a pretty extreme immigration policy. At another point in the hearing, he said, "I do not recognize the Norwegian courts. You have received your mandate from political parties which support multiculturalism. I do not acknowledge the authority of the court." So basically the trial will go on, and obviously I don't think they're going to contest that he committed the murders. What they are going to go over is whether he was insane or not. Obviously he's a nutcase, and don't ask me when somebody's killed that many people how you declare whether he's insane or sane, because
I think he's even I was reading that he's even challenging apparently the maximum penalty that he can be assessed is 21 years in prison.
That's the maximum.
Which,
what's up? That's the maximum, 21 years in prison?
That's what I was reading, and he
wow.
was scoffing at that and saying that if he were found guilty, he should be executed himself. There's also talk about he is spoken of in his long diary that he wrote, 1,000 pages, he claimed that there was others, and he was part of a Knights Templar organization, and he's been challenged to provide the names and contacts of the other people he's met with, and that has only met with silence on his part. So, you know, if it is a 21-year limit, it's a very interesting policy that they have over there in Scandinavia, since I think actually a good thing, the death penalty is banned. But a lot of times what they try to do is reform the inmates. But in a situation like this,
good
you know,
luck
21, 21 years doesn't quite seem...
Yeah, he's only 33, I guess, so he would
yeah.
be 54. Whoa.
Maybe 70, 77 times 21, maybe that'll be enough.
Yeah, that's true. There you go.
hopefully that applies and he doesn't, the law doesn't require that he serve them all concurrently, that he can get serial sentencing, and that basically keeps him locked up. But the thing that struck me is his resistance. I mean, basically the reason he gave, yes, he declared that it was self-defense, but when you read what he actually had to say about his motivation for the crimes, his motivation was, like you mentioned in your report, he was resisting multiculturalism. He was resisting Islamic immigration. And there was a little piece of me that said, you know, that's not completely different from the southern border of the United States, because one of the major arguments made by the right as to why we should not allow people to be immigrating to this country is to keep the Muslims out. Now, where all these Muslims are coming into Mexico, I don't know, but that is one of the arguments that some of the more extreme right-wingers make, and the parallel is just... It just struck me. I'm not saying that these right-wingers are going to go out and mass murder people.
It's the same line of reasoning.
But the
right?
reasoning is similar. The
it's
reasoning
exactly
is similar. Frighteningly similar.
Yeah, I don't think there's any difference. Once you take that position, it's all the same position. And I agree, it's not the same. It's not as extreme, of course. I mean, the guy just says that's the most extreme. Other than going to war, one nation against the other because they're different color or whatever. What that guy did was the most extreme act. But, yeah, it's the same reasoning.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've only got a couple minutes left, but I've been mentioning the Republicans a few times, let's take a quick look at what's going on with the race. And Jake, you have some interesting details about stuff that isn't getting a whole lot of attention, but it's kind of raising a few eyebrows within the Republican Party.
Right. An article put out on Washington Times about the Colorado delegate selection, which the straw poll in Colorado, for those that are unaware, Santorum won with 40% of the popular vote. Romney got second with 35%, and Ron Paul finished with 12%. Apparently, Gingrich wasn't even on the ballot. When it came down to the delegates, and you can go through the labyrinthian way that they select these delegates, but when they got through it, one of the delegates is unpledged, and he said that 13 of the unpledged delegates will be voting for Ron Paul on the first ballot. He said one unpledged delegate will vote for Santorum, and the other three unpledged delegates are the state GOP chairman, the state GOP national committee man, and the state GOP national committee woman. So those three, you know, are probably going to likely vote for Romney, because there's nobody else. Santorum, there's no other establishment really in the race. But so what it works out to is that Romney has 13 pledged delegates, and again, it's unknown how many of them will vote for another candidate on a second ballot, but there's 13 pledged delegates to Romney. There's 13 unpledged delegates to Ron Paul, and there's 7 to Santorum, as well as 3 of the at-large candidates that are the state GOP folks. So in this state where, you know, he just got 12%, really he's finishing in a virtual tie for first place in delegates. The question is, you know, is this going to happen in a bunch of other states? I'd say probably not so much, but it's probably going to be a lot more than the media is reporting. And again, I still think that it's more likely than not, better than 50-50, that even though Santorum has pulled out, that Romney doesn't get the required number of delegates on the first vote.
Well, quite possibly, and we're out of time here, but I just want to spend 10 seconds pointing out that there's another story coming out of Alaska that the Ron Paul campaign is condemning efforts by the Alaskan Republican Party and its chairman, Randy Rudrick, to disenfranchise Paul and other non-Romney delegates to the party's upcoming state convention. And when you hear about what happened, basically the Republican Party at the last minute started putting in all these requirements about how much money they had to put up as delegates to attend, and then there were changes in how they were going to make the payments and so forth. They basically led them around by the nose until the deadline for filing was passed to basically prevent the non-Romney delegates from attending the convention. It's an absolute nightmare. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, so I can't go into that story anymore in any more detail. But, gentlemen, as usual, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, it has.
And we will see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.